You're listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Only here, lastwordonsports.com.
What's up, Internet? My name is Matt Pollard, and you are listening to Last Word Soccer Club Radio, only here, lastwordonsoccer.com, powered by Last Word on Sports Incorporated, the Beautiful Game Network, and Roughneck Scarves. We've got a great show for you tonight. We'll be recapping the very disappointing first legs of the quarterfinals of CONCACAF Champions League, and also talking about week one in MLS and looking forward to the rest of this weekend. But first of all, let me bring in my co-host, Daniel Sperry. Dan, how are you doing tonight, my friend?
I'm doing quite well. It looks like winter is done in Kansas City. Knock on wood. I'm excited. We've got some games coming up this week. We got plenty to talk about. MLS is back. Yeah, and we're finally done with. I think we're out of like what felt like Planet Hoth for like. So yeah, things. Happy thoughts. I don't have to work tomorrow either, and we're doing this really late at night, so that makes me very happy.
Excellent stuff. I am still in the thralls of winter. We had freezing rain, and I was driving home from work and trying to catch the first half of the Atlanta CCL game, so that wasn't fun, and woke up to a whole bunch of ice in the roads. I will be going to Winter Park on Sunday for the first time ever. I'm mostly an epic local. That doesn't mean anything to you if you're not from Colorado, Utah, or Tahoe in California. But so I have not been to Winter Park. I've not skied there. I am getting a new pair of powder skis that I'm really excited about that my bindings are ready to pick up tomorrow. So I'll be working on that. And then I think maybe one or two more ski days and then I'm ready at least in the front range for things to start melting. There'll still be some snow all the way up in the Rockies for a couple of more months and I'm okay with that. I actually didn't have a friend who used to work in Rocky Mountain National Park, who on one of his days off actually did some backcountry skiing, only like 100 straight vertical feet, in the month of July a couple years ago. So, technically, I guess you can go skiing in Colorado almost every all 12 months, but I'm ready for it to be soccer season, not skiing season. On that note, Dan, let's look back at the past 2 days. Tuesday night, you had New York Red Bulls and Houston Dynamo both losing at home by a score of 2-0. I would say almost prototypical That's So Metro situation with them in Santos Laguna, where they come out, they play some really good soccer. Daniel Royer and Bradley Wright Phillips have a couple really good shots that are saved or just open opportunities that they didn't make. And then Santos gets one really good chance and they bury it. Ultimately, are able to get a 2-0 victory. I think you tweeted this out, Dan. I'm not sure that I've ever watched a game on a stream from BBVA Compass Stadium that was louder than how it was on Tuesday night with all the Tigres fans who were in there. I presume some traveling, some just generally from the state of Texas, and obviously Houston fans who I think were excited about the furthest they've ever gotten in this iteration of the tournament. But again, I think very typical given where Houston were having to play over the weekend and then taking on a very, very good Liga MX side. And then last night you had Sporting Kansas City surviving against Kai down in Panama by a score of 2-1. And then Atlanta getting pretty thoroughly smoked against Monterrey. Dan, your general thoughts on the Leg One series? And I mean, was this a train that we should have seen coming as far as hitting us? Because I feel like once again we're having the conversation of I was so excited about MLS and CCL and now I'm just disappointed again and I should have known this. Is it proverbial MLS CCL fever Groundhog's Day right now?
Yeah, I think so. Just because here's the difference here is, last year we got some American teams beating CCL, or at least some MLS teams beating Liga MX teams in CCL, but you had one of the greatest teams in MLS history in Toronto FC that was able to get the job done at home first. I think that's a really big thing, is that if you can't get the job done at home first, like New York Red Bulls, like Houston, I mean, those series right there are set up the best for MLS teams, because these Mexican teams don't really travel, to the States well, just like we don't travel to Mexico very well. At least MLS teams don't travel to Mexico really well. If you look across history, there's a lot of draws that have happened, and some and plenty of victories that have happened in the United States for MLS teams over Liga MX teams. It is very rare that there are wins down there. So while Atlanta, I kind of expected, Monterrey is a tough place to play. That is an awesome stadium that they have down there, and they are one of the best, deepest teams. And Dorlan Pabon, it might be one of my favorite players in the current North and Central, in the current CONCACAF region right now, maybe even the entire North and South American side of the world, I guess Western Hemisphere, whatever you want to call it. Anyways, you know, Monterrey, this is like, oh gosh, I'm trying to think. This would be like Red Bull Leipzig, and Borussia Dortmund against Barcelona. Well, not this year's Real Madrid, because we all know they got bounced really heavily. But this is like, you know, you, so fine. Okay. So they get through the first round for, round of 16, and then they come into the quarterfinals. And now they actually have to play the big boys, the guys who are 22 first team players deep. You know, Sporting Kansas City's deep. Atlanta's pretty deep. Red Bull New York, pride themselves, you know, they're all deep for MLS. In reality, they're not 22 first choice potential players deep like a Monterrey is, like, a Tigres is, and, really, I mean, even eight first deep. Not really many MLS teams are that deep. And that kind of showed, because it's still going on as MLS is now. Both Liga MX teams and MLS teams are having to rotate squads through the weekends, and trying congestion. And because of roster construction, the way Liga MX does things and MLS, this was bound to happen. And I, you know, last year, Toronto, I believe, caught, Tigres, I believe, before Toronto even started their regular season. So, that, you know, that's one of those things where they don't have those tired legs. They're not already within that, you know, mess of fixture congestion. So, I think right there for disaster for MLS, we should have seen it coming. And I think this year's contingent of Liga MX teams are probably, much better than they were last year. Because last year you had a very weak Solos team. You had a Chivas USA team that was struggling, and towards the bottom, or not Chivas USA team, but a Chivas team that eventually won the tournament, but were at the time they were struggling in Liga MX. Tigres was not where they were supposed to be. And I don't believe Monterrey was in the competition. There was another, Liga MX team that is escaping me at the moment, name wise, but, that was, Club America. Yeah. And Club America at that point was at one of the only the team that constantly is in it. But, you know, Club America was also in a miserable state, within their Liga MX run and stuff like that. So, you know, this year the MLS only caught one of the teams, who fired their manager in the middle of the whole thing. So, you know, I think this was a train, like you said, this is a train that we probably should have seen, that, you know, the Monterrey, the Tigres is very good. Houston, although I think a much better MLS team could have potentially missed a run for their money. They didn't play Gignac. I didn't think they were that, and they kind of got things done late, but they still won and were better. I don't think is necessarily the best MLS team in this tournament. Swap them out for LAFC. Things could have potentially been different, maybe tighter, and maybe at least a draw, maybe even a tight win for an LAFC. But, you know, Houston just are, to not get shellacked by a Tigres team is probably a pretty good thing anyways, considering it was a road game. But yeah, like you said, I will say, so train we should have seen coming. And then to the point of BBVA Compass Stadium, 100%. Probably the loudest I think I've ever heard it, seen it. It was really cool to see all those fans there. That is not a very long drive. I believe they were saying on the broadcast 8 hours or something like that drive, from Monterrey to Houston. Not a long drive. A lot of Tigres fans in that area. Monterrey, I believe, is the closest large Mexican city to, Houston and stuff like that. So, you know, Monterrey, Tigres are from Monterrey. So, themselves are, you know, it was impressive, what they've been able to do over the last few years down in Liga MX. They come down, create an absolutely incredible atmosphere down, in Houston. And, that, you know, I think that kind of, that might have been the difference for, a Tigres team that is starting to get a little long in the tooth and is starting to, you know, I won't say they're kind of on their way down in Liga MX compared to like a Monterrey, Cruz Azul, and a few others who have been coming up. So, But all in all, should have seen this all coming. For luckily, Sporting are kind of in the situation that they're in, but they'll have to play a Monterrey next anyways, which I don't think bodes that well for them, considering the way their squad rotation is done. So unless they entirely sell out their first team for CONCACAF Champions League only until they're out, you know, it's going to be a tough road for them. But I definitely think they've got themselves the best set up for a second leg too.
I hear what you're saying, Dan. You know, I think there were points where maybe I was disappointed in the performance or some of the adjustments that Sporting Kansas City was doing. But I mean, if you told me right now they were going to win the second leg 2-0, 3-1, and, you know, comfortably have the aggregate advantage, especially with that all critical road goal, I wouldn't be totally surprised. So, you know, I maybe would have wanted a little bit more from Sporting Kansas City if they were 100% and taking a fully fit first team. But I mean, they've been put through the ringer as basically from their home opener until now, between having to go play at Toluca, then having to go play at LAFC. And then, if I'm not mistaken, Dan, they did not go back to Kansas. They haven't been back to Kansas City until after the game against Kai, correct?
Against the game against Kai.
If I'm not mistaken, so it would have been home game against Toluca in the first round.
First leg against Toluca was Thursday night. Friday and Saturday, they left Saturday night for Albuquerque, and they have not been home since. They went from Albuquerque to Toluca to LA to Panama, and they landed in Kansas City this afternoon.
Okay, so I mean, you know, any MLS team goes through that ring. Any Liga MX team would have to go through that, and I would expect, you know, that final game to be brutal. But, you know, I thought scoreline may be a little bit flattering, but the result is very much in hand, and I think there's a lot of things that they'll be able to do with home field advantage, with regular night sleep, with Matt Beasler actually getting to spend two straight nights a row in his bed in Kansas City. I think they're going to be okay. I didn't have much of a hope or a prayer.
And a real, like, quality field, because that field, I think, played a significant role in their inability to play like we would have expected them to play.
I would completely agree, Dan. You know, I didn't really have a whole lot of faith in the Houston Dynamo, if I'm being completely honest, just where their roster is. You know, they've got a very CONCACAF-y roster, but it's CONCACAF-y in a Saprissa sort of way. And normally you don't think about you don't think that Saprissa going up against Tigres or any team in Liga MX is going to be able to hold their own. And then so I didn't have a whole lot of faith in them. In general, I would say of all the MLS teams getting into this tournament, the one that automatically I would have the least faith in all honesty, would be the Open Cup, just because it's the most random of them. Whereas normally the Supporters Shield or the MLS Cup winner is generally regarded as one of the better teams in MLS. You know, whereas DC United, who had the worst record in MLS in 2013, won the Open Cup that year and was in Champions League the following year. So I think that explains those sort of two. The ones where I may be a little bit disappointed, or where I think the people getting the narrative that, oh, here we go again, or this is an indication of Liga MX still being superior over MLS, were the results for the New York Red Bulls and Atlanta United. I would say on paper last year, the two best teams in MLS based on the Supporter Shield table. And I would say at worst, two of the top four teams in MLS. You know, if the other two that I would have to throw in there right now, probably LAFC and the aforementioned Sporting Kansas City, if I'm being completely honest. So you've got two of the top four teams in MLS right now, pound for pound, against, I would argue, at least two of the top four teams in Liga MX, and they got played off the field. One home game, one away game, not a whole lot of adjustments. I expressed a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about this on the pod, my reservations around Atlanta, just with the coaching change and Miguel Almiron not really being there and the team being in preseason. You know, they were able to figure it out in the first round, but you know, we can kind of see now we have three games worth of data points to indicate that DeBoer has some changes that he wants to see coming, that the roster wasn't immediately ready for, or that's going to take some time for them to gel. And normally the teams that have success in Champions League are the ones that are ready to go right out the gate. Last year, Greg Vanney's had a really good quote when I spoke with him after the first leg against Colorado in the first round, where he said, you know, the old version of the tournament of regular season qualification, the old group stage game when MLS teams were still in the group stage of CCL, and then the actual knockout round. You needed three teams in order to win the tournament. You had to have a really good team to qualify, then you had a team that had a lot of depth in order to get through the first round, and then you had to have a team that was ready to compete with a Liga MX team. Now you really just need two back-to-back years, but really that offseason isn't an offseason. It's just reloading or preparing for that next round, and you can't really do that when you have a major coaching change, and then I would argue your best player leaving the club and then somebody else coming in. That's just going to cause some dischemistry that then has to get sorted through, and that's not conducive in this tournament. So I still had reservations around Atlanta. I was maybe, if it had been 1-0 or 2-0, I would have been okay, but I think 3-0 was a pretty poor performance for them, especially given the other three games that they had played going into that one. And, you know, Red Bull's going to Red Bull, but, you know, I thought maybe they would have figured it out or at least gotten a goal or at least made it manageable. But, I mean, you know, I wouldn't be shocked at all if the final aggregate score of Red Bulls against Santos, you know, would end up being like 5-1 or something like that. I would imagine Tigres is going to be jogging in the second half at home against Houston Dynamo, and it's not really going to be close. And, you know, yeah, it's going to be, you know, a big stadium and a good atmosphere at Mercedes-Benz, but a lot's going to have to happen for Atlanta. And I think, you know, that's an environment that I would expect Atlanta to thrive in against a Costa Rican team or against a Panamanian team. But I mean, you know, I think Monterrey probably looks at it and says, oh, you know, it's the American equivalent of Club America in terms of the environment and the loudness and the fans being all up close to you. Maybe not as much CONCACAF thing. I would hope that Atlanta fans are, are classier than, you know, throwing cups of bodily fluid a la, you know, that a la the USA-Mexico game where Landon Donovan had cups of bodily fluid thrown at him. But, you know, that's not an environment that's going to be all that different from Monterrey. It's not that very different from what they experienced in their home stadium, what they experienced going to play at Tigres, or anything that they would get when they have to go play against Club America at the Azteca. So, you know, and again, you know, all Monterrey needs is one of those. And if I have my math correct, Atlanta would need to score 5. I don't know that we're going to see that from them, especially given that they have to play another game this weekend. So, I think Sporting gets through the next round. I would not favor them at all against Monterrey, and I'd be shocked if any of the other MLS teams find a way to advance out of it. And if they do, I would expect that there'd have to be some level of CONCACAFing or a lucky red card. It would not be they will not be advancing on their merits. There will have to be some aspect of luck in the second leg that gets them over it. I guess on that note, Dan, can you handicap, you know, let's presume Monterrey and Sporting get through the second legs relatively unscathed as far as injuries or yellow card accumulation. Can you handicap anything? Would Sporting really have a prayer at beating two Liga MX teams to win this tournament?
Maybe one more. You know, I could see them doing one more, and I think that, you know, this team's kind of growing in together. Like I said, if they manage the roster rotation and scheduling rotation and stuff like that, actually, it was pulling up. Let me see if I can pull up my Google Doc real quick. But I was looking at just the potential fixture congestion, and I wasn't even including road games when I was pulling this up. But so this is not including road games. They will play, so the second leg, so the first leg of the semifinal, is the week of between April 2nd and April 4th. They have a game on Saturday the 30th, and then the second leg is the ensuing week. So the 9th to the 11th, is the potential leg 2 for semis. And I believe Sporting Kansas City, have a road game in between that. If I can pull it up real quick. Sorry. So Sporting Kansas City will be playing, at FC Cincinnati, in between those semifinals. So a potential, another round of road trip, it could be on the horizon if they were even to get to the semifinals. And then the finals, would be the week of April 23rd and then the week of April 30th. So then the following weeks there. So, you know, the fixture congestion and stuff, they're going to have to figure out a way to manage, the stress on that to the finals. You know, I think they'll get through this round. I think they will, be very lucky to get through a semifinal against or something like that. But if they can do that, then they might as well put your money on them to win the final. I believe they can get there going through a tough Monterrey, probably the best team in the tournament, in my opinion. Then I think certainly be able to win the whole thing. So handicap it. I mean, I think there's probably I'll give them a 30% chance of winning the tournament. I think that's about as good as it's going to get at this moment. I'll probably give them a 70% chance to get through the quarterfinals for sure and get to the semifinals. But I just think coming up against much better teams, what Monterrey, with the help of some solid CONCACAFing last night, were able to do to dispel any of Atlanta's possession and potential counters and moves forward and stuff like that was really well done. And I think that's probably they're going to have to face throughout CCL a lot if they continue on. So can Sporting win the whole thing? I think they could, but it's a very slim chance. They're probably the best MLS team equipped to do it. But to get to the semifinals, I expect them to. You kind of expect them to get through the second leg at home, a 2-3 does it for them. So, they don't surrender too many goals. I don't see the game playing out the way it did, last night in the second leg, especially, Sporting Kansas City at home, likely with their first choice players. So we'll see what happens if they get to the semifinals. But, like I said, I don't know if I have too much faith in them to win the whole thing. Just at the current moment.
Let's move on to MLS action, Dan. One of the things that I often lamented while covering the Rapids in 2018 was with the, being in the Mountain Time Zone and having to leave when I needed to get there for what was usually a 7 p.m. Saturday Mountain Standard Time kickoff, usually involved me missing the second half of a lot of the Eastern Conference, the Eastern Time Zone kickoffs, and then just getting home in time for some of the, say the last 30 minutes of the all of the West Coast games. So I missed a lot of the games in order to cover the Rapids, and usually on that Saturday match day, typically the game that was the least exciting usually was one that involved the Colorado Rapids. So it was kind of nice on Saturday, albeit with a little bit of frostbite and possibly some missing toes and fingers, to be the envy of the soccer world, because Saturday night at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, Dan, I witnessed in person Snow Classico 3. The Colorado Rapids played to a 3. We will call. I have been calling it a 3-3 win over the Portland Timbers. The Rapids get a goal just 16 minutes into the game from Kai Kamara. Some really good play from them. Anthony Hudson has been big on trying to be more of a possession team, an attacking team that throws numbers forwards. The snow starts to really pile down. Axel Schuberg gets sent off for a handball that, in my opinion, was ball to hand, but apparently MLS has a very narrow view on what they allow as ball to hand and what is considered a hand being in a natural position. Diego Valeri buries the rebound on the free kick, or on the PK, and then the snow just starts pouring down. It becomes a winter wonderland. There is a cloud of snow and ice around Dick's Sporting Goods Park. I could barely see the orange ball from the upper deck outdoor press box. It was a really fun experience. At halftime, I actually had to tell you that I had to shut down my computer because I kept wiping it off and I was making moisture that was then freezing, and I had to punch down on my laptop keys in order to actually get it to function. It just wasn't working. So I just said, okay, I'm just going to plug in my phone and do everything for my phone and keep it warm and dry in my pocket, and we'll make that work. And at the end of the day, there were about 3 to 4 inches of snow. It was, as of the starting kickoff time, it was the coldest game in MLS league history, regular season or playoffs. The Rapids, of course, as of last year, holding the record for the coldest game an MLS team had ever played in the big chill at Dick's Sporting Goods Park. This was an absolute madness of a game, Dan. It had everything you'd wanted. You had Sebastian Blanco scoring a goal on a header off of a corner at 5'7". I looked back on it. He was the third shortest player of the 22 on the field, and he got got a header on that. You had a PK. You had a red card. You had a Declan Wynn own goal from him slipping because he was piling up on a whole bunch of powder. You had guys falling down with regularity. You had free kicks where the free kick taker was slipping and losing their footing because they couldn't get their foot down because there was all the snow. And then it ended, I think, as perfectly as it could be. The Rapids' main draft pick, Andre Shinyashiki, who they moved up in the draft to get, a DU pioneer, playing in his, I would say, his adoptive hometown. He's originally from Brazil, but obviously he'd been living in Denver, going to DU at the back post off of Jeff Atenella slipping and not being able to grab the ball, just palming it away straight to him, completely unguarded at the back post, tapping it in short sleeves, going towards the sideline, full knee slide into a snow mosh pit with snowballs flinging. I was joking around with everybody, every single person walking out of Dick's Sporting Goods Park who I ran into that night had a huge smile on their face, and it spoke of thinking, the last 2 hours I've absolutely hated myself for coming out tonight and for staying there, but this is an amazing story and I'm gonna love telling it for years to come. Dan, how did you experience it watching it in the highlights, and just how does someone who wasn't there sort of view those sorts of games and trying to make sense of it or trying to understand what that condition was like?
Yeah, well, I've never played in snow, but I've played on like an entirely frozen field, and that sucks and it freaking hurt. But I will say one, ESPN Plus stupid. I couldn't watch this match. It was clearly the best match of its time slot, and I was stuck with Houston and RSL and Minnesota and Vancouver on my TV and my laptop instead of a wonderful snow Classico 3 featuring the Colorado Rapids, who are one of my favorite dark horse teams this year, a Portland Timbers team that frustrates the heck out of me sometimes. But, I thought the highlights were fun. Red card, pretty well deserved. You know, we get into that part for Schuberg. I will say, the initial signs that I saw from the Rapids were really promising of what that front group can bring. And Diego Rubio is fantastic at linking up with other, as long as one of them up there is kind of doing some of the defensive work. Diego Rubio isn't the greatest at it or the most consistent with his defensive work and pressing, but when he does, he makes things happen and can turn the ball over and can quickly either finish or feed somebody. And I think he and Kai working in tandem up top is just going to be a lot of fun to watch. I've always said Diego Rubio is better suited for a 4-4 or for a two man up top than he was a single striker with Sporting Kansas City. If there wasn't enough connection and movement between the front three of the Sporting Kansas City, it was a bad night for him if he was kind of all on his own. So seeing him in a system like that and seeing it show signs very early in the game, when the field was probably at its most conducive point to play actual soccer. That's the hardest part is, almost 60 minutes of that game, in terms of what you can take away from it, just because of the absolute, bonkers, that the Snow Classico was. So it was fun. My favorite, lasting image from all of it is still Drew Fisher's face, just frozen with, snow in his eyebrow, and mustache and nostril. I mean, it is a wonderful picture if you haven't seen it. It's beautiful. I think the closest thing I've ever come to it was last year when I went, to Chicago. It was freezing. It was definitely cold enough to snow. There was just no snow or precipitation, but it was freezing down there, in Bridgeview, and Sporting was up 2-0. And then Chicago back. And I don't normally sit with supporters sections, but, that was where I was able to get dirt cheap tickets. So we were sitting with the Sporting KC supporters section, right next to the Cauldron, actually, but still kind of, it was just a massive group of Sporting KC supporters. And then they scored two goals, in the last 5 minutes to come back and win that game. And the euphoria that everybody kind of felt there was super cool. A lot of fun comebacks. I've been a part of comebacks and stuff like that with Sporting or with the San Jose Earthquakes, if you remember the Goonies, but feeling of walking out of there like being literally numb for the most part, and then getting into a car and then searching for the nearest Portillo's to drown some Italian beef and cheesy fries, that's what we were looking for to freaking warm So, you know, it was, I understand it. And I think it's a cool thing for the Rapids. There's a lot of, like, people who are going to take interest. Okay, there's this crazy snow game that they shot down a man. They probably shouldn't have even been in that game at that point. But the snow kind of made everything crazy. Hey, they're actually pretty good. They play good soccer. And I think it's going to be able to pull in, some fans outside of their current crop that's, you know, sticking with them through thick and thin, mostly thick. I think this kind of a game, is going to be a very good thing to bring attention to the Rapids within the Denver market, especially with the Broncos and their mess. The Rockies are solid. You have the Nuggets. The Avs are bad. But, like, you know, there's another team. I think Colorado Rapids kind of captivating the Denver market through some bonkers crap that happened on the other night. I think it's going to be really good for them in the long run.
Yeah, no, like I said, there was every single person who I knew who was there has had nothing but wonderful things to say about it in the aftermath, even if in the actual moment we were actually just completely losing ourselves. The one thing that I will say that maybe was helping C38 out there, I don't know if you saw it, Dan, the Denver Post picked up a photo that one of the supporters tweeted out at the Big Chill last year against Toronto. The beer taps actually froze, and there was like a frozen, almost like sculpture from a lady yeah. who was trying to pour out, I assume probably Coors Light, and that froze out. The beer taps, as far as I know, completely held through the end of the night, and if nothing else, on the south end of the stadium, near section 117 where C38 sits, they're just you go up the concourse and then right there is the bar 1878. That's mm-hmm. the year Colorado as a state was founded. That is an indoor bar area that is heated, so then you can still get your various beverages, alcoholic or sugary or just regular ice water there. So again, like I said, it was one of those where it was absolutely miserable to try to endure, just from a human being standpoint, from trying to actually cover that game, just given the conditions with an outdoor press box that didn't have full roof coverage was a mess. But I mean, you know, that automatically, on top of all the games that I've covered since joining Last Word back in 2014, like, this is at least top five. It's hands down top three, and I think maybe the only other game off the top of my head that I think that would absolutely stand up against it was when I covered the CONCACAF Cup, the one game playoff between Mexico and the U.S. to get into the Club World Cup that was at the Rose Bowl in early fall 2015, I believe. And that was that one went into extra time, and Bobby Wood came off the bench and scored a goal, and it was just absolutely crazy. That was my first media experience with USA versus Mexico in a fantastic venue with two fantastic teams that just had everything you could ask for other than 4 inches of snow on the ground, which made it much easier to cover. But in any case, there's a general topic that I want to talk about tonight, Dan, about the first week of the season, or the results of the first week are indicative of this theme that I have noticed. With the exception of, I think, four games, Minnesota over Vancouver, DC United winning 2-0 over Atlanta, LAFC beat Sporting Kansas City at the death with Adama Diomande coming off the bench, or there were five, excuse me, Toronto beat Philadelphia, and then Montreal beat San Jose. Those were five wins, and then every single other game, LA Galaxy won, and then Seattle won. In any case, I've just named all the almost
it half feels like a dr- yes. It feels like it, there was a crap ton of draws.
Yes, it felt like there were a crap ton of draws. Statistically, there were half of them were draws, and then a lot of them were 1-1 draws. And that, I think, but there were also lots of chances, you know, like I feel like Red Bulls Columbus, for example, had another goal in it. I feel like more could have been had.
If Pedro Santos didn't like kick the ball like and eat crap at the end, that was hilarious. I was dying laughing. I was also screaming, just hit the pass, because Jussie's artist is wide open. All he's got to do is not take an extra touch and hit the pass, and that game was over. It would have been 2-1. But it's funny because there's a Columbus Crew fan whose video kind of went viral after Matt Doyle like retweeted it, and he is sitting there screaming, "Just pass it! Just get rid! Like, send the ball! Send it into the box!" Which is funny because, like, in the exact moment I was screaming that at my TV. So the enjoyable thing week, especially enjoyable mistakes, like watching the New England FC Dallas game.
Yeah, well, my response to that, Dan, is Pedro Santos going to Pedro Santos, and Jossie's artist can't score or somehow manage to flub something up with his first touch if nobody ever actually passes him the ball. Fact, if Jossie's artist gets zero touches over the course of a 90-minute soccer game, he has zero bad first touches in said soccer game. But so in any case, there were a crap ton of draws. There seemed like a lot of opportunities. We have talked, and there is a narrative within MLS about how most of the big money is going towards attackers. You know, there are players in MLS right now who in their prime were some of the best players in the world, and most of them are forwards or number 10s or goal-scoring wingers. You know, I think of Nani, who made his debut and had an assist for Orlando City. Obviously, there was a point in which Wayne Rooney and Zlatan Ibrahimovic were the best players on their respective national teams that were expected to qualify and compete in the World Cup. But, you know, there isn't, you know, there's no, the world's best center backs right now aren't in 4 to 5 years in the back half of their career coming to MLS to sign DP contracts to be the big poster boy and sell a whole bunch of jerseys. The young main attackers from Central and South America who in 4 to 5 years' time are going to be major defensive players in Europe aren't necessarily coming to MLS, or neither of those things are happening with the level of frequency that they are on the attacking side of the ball. So early season, you have the impact of neither side being particularly sharp, but generally one side just being much better from a technical standpoint, from a money standpoint, from an experience standpoint, but then that not necessarily leading to more goals right now. But we've seen historically over the course of an entire season, as MLS has grown, as more money's coming into it, as more international talent comes in, we've seen that it has been more of a scoring league. I have referred to it, Dan, you know, in MLS 2.0, the teams that were winning to get into the playoffs, the teams that were competing for MLS Cup were the ones who were able to win games 1-0. Those were teams who were able to gut out and survive 0-0 draws on the road in a first leg road game. And now it seems increasingly that MLS is a 2-1 league, and at times I would argue even a 3-2 league. Your thoughts on this weekend, all of the draws, and the word salad of a thesis that I am contemplating right now and trying to make sense of?
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. I thought this week was interesting just because, I mean, week one, there's always a lot of surprise results. Like last year, the San Jose Earthquakes looked fantastic for 60 minutes and won a game, and then they did only won three more in their next 33 games, right? You know, there's so much. Like last year, what was another one? Oh, Sporting Kansas City looked atrocious in their first game, and everyone was like, oh crap, what's going on here? You know, they win the Western Conference. You know, LAFC looked pretty good. Seattle was absolute trash for 2 months. So it's very hard to like take away some over, like, massive things from week one. I think for me, at least, outside of the draws, like, you see the teams that drew, and it's all teams that are very similar to each other, like FC, or at least in similar places, like Columbus, New York Red Bulls. I don't think New York Red Bulls is going to be as good as they were last year. Now, what I've seen through CCL and through their MLS, I don't think they're going to be as good as they were last year, but I think they're still good. Columbus Crew, I think, are still very good. I don't think they're going, I think they'll be a little bit better than last year, potentially. But like, you know, looking at them, they're both kind of in the same spot. If you know, if Red Bull New York takes a step back, they both kind of end up in the same spot. FC Dallas, New England, pretty much the same spot. Houston and RSL, pretty much the same spot. A lot of young talent. So I think that was the really interesting thing. And then Orlando and New York City FC, you've got, two teams that are just incredibly unbalanced. You know, Orlando's back line is trash. New York City FC's midfield got ripped apart in the second half, and looked really bad. And even their back line was pretty miserable. So, you know, I think that's the hard part is you see the draws and stuff like that where they came from teams that are going into the season. You kind of view them in the same spot. And then the wins, outside of the LAFC, the LAFC Sporting Kansas City game, I think the Colorado Portland game, I wouldn't say they were surprising results, but results that were like, okay, this team really got something out of it. Like LAFC and Colorado obviously come away the winners from it because LAFC were down and out against Sporting Kansas City. Sporting Kansas City looked like the team through 30 minutes. And then LAFC poured it on in the second half and were able to get a last minute winner. Colorado withstood all the crap not bad crap, but just stuff, even their own issues that they created, were able to get a draw in crazy circumstances. So, like, you know, you look at all of those games that are going on there, and, you know, obviously Seattle destroying Cincinnati, and then, you know, DC United and Atlanta. Atlanta's kind of in an odd situation, but DC United always beats them anyways, so it doesn't matter. But, like, it's when, you know, you look at all these results across League One, or across Week One, I think the one thing you can take away from is that it's pretty clear, I think, where teams are standing in regards to each other. Like, I think a lot of these is nice too, because you had a lot of fringe, quote, fringe matchups. Like RSL Houston are two, but, you know, people would expect to be fighting for a playoff spot, and there's a chance that one doesn't make it. Same with Orlando, New York City FC. You know, not a whole lot of people are high in New York City FC this year. At least as high as they have. You know, Colorado or Columbus and New York Red Bulls, kind of, you expect to kind of be in the same jumbled place within an Eastern Conference. So, I think it's interesting. To me, it just kind of spells a lot more of the parity in this league. It was nice to not have a 0-0 draw. I will say that. Not one game I watched had a 0-0 draw. So a lot of interesting things there. But I think the lines of where teams are going to fall in terms of their category, what we were for the season, where we said, all right, we think this team is a contender. This team is bottom feeder. This team is a potential, you know, conference champion type team. I went through there. I think those lines already are kind of pretty obvious. And I think, as you said, that kind of goes to the overall growth and on the top end, and then the separation between the bottom end and the league, that it's already kind of shaping up in a way that's pretty predictable. Not predictable, but you can predict where teams kind of from where we're at so far, it feels like.
Well said, Dan. Just one last topic we have before we move on to rapid fire and pick-ems in the round table. I watched the Sporting Kansas City LAFC game on Sunday, and that, of all the games that I saw over the weekend, I felt that was the closest one to a playoff game in terms of quality of play, clear plan from both managers as far as the game plan was concerned, and just the back and forth, chaosy aspects of it. You know, you had some curious situations from an officiating standpoint, and ultimately, I would say, a spectacular ending, albeit one that you and everybody in Kansas City maybe weren't particularly happy about. But, you know, I feel like every single time I can remember Kansas City taking on LAFC, it has been a very competitive game. It has been a well-played game, and it's been a little bit of a chess match between the two managers, who I would argue are two of the more brilliant minds in MLS, and certainly two of the best American coaches in MLS right now. And I was already kind of thinking these were the creme de la creme of the Western Conference, and we could very well see them competing for the Western Conference title or potentially for the Supporters Shield. Certainly they could meet in the Western Conference Finals. Your thoughts on that game on Sunday and what it could mean as far as that being a barometer for who the best in the West is going into this year?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the only thing I can say, if you're going to use it as a barometer, right? The only thing I can say is you can put a little asterisk next to Sporting Kansas City just because of what they had endured over the week, travel-wise and altitude-wise and physicality-wise. And Peter Vermees, instead of doing a slight rotation for back-to-back games, he chose to do no rotation and then a significant rotation. So I think the whole rotation thing is going to be a learning process for him this year, just because he's literally never done it in his career. Very rarely has he had to do it. And even then, it's been like maybe two players, which I probably could have expected like three different players in the side for Sunday and something like that. But he didn't do any of that. It was the same squad that was run out over the weekend, and, you know, same guys that were subbed on. It was Kellen Rowe. It was Daniel Shallowy. It was, Eric Hurtado, but I think someone else came on. That game, as you said, and as many have pointed out, was the closest thing to a playoff game. I think it shows how good those two were. What will be interesting to see is how good those two potentially look against a Seattle in the coming weeks ahead, because I think Seattle is the only other team right now in the Western Conference that clearly, I think, belongs in that conversation, but I would like to see how close they belong to that conversation. I think they'll be right in it with them. But, you know, that was an incredible matchup. You know, Sporting Kansas City LFC played two really tight games last year. Sporting Kansas City did get a win down there. I thought they just kind of got tired in the second half, made some mental mistakes, and just weren't able to get into their rhythm and get out of the... I did have chances. Johnny Russell came on, or Johnny Russell had a few chances there and to do something, and I believe Gerso had one where it was almost a breakaway, and he fell and ate it at the top of the 18 and could have potentially, I think at that point, made it 2-1 to Sporting. So there was chances for Sporting Kansas City to win this. LFC ultimately took advantage of them and advantage of the mistakes that Sporting Kansas City had made throughout the and did a good job. It's kind of what I would expect. I mean, LAFC is a solid team, so I would expect them to potentially get a win, to squeak it out at home. I don't think it's necessarily a black mark on Sporting Kansas City, but it does show how tight those two teams are at the top. And I think the biggest question for it, period, is, you know, who steps up to challenge. I think Seattle's there to challenge for sure. But to see how much of a challenge we'll have to see in the coming weeks for sure. But, a wonderful game, for the season to end, or for the first to end with, a great, overall performance from both sides. It was a great game to watch, for neutrals and people who, had some investment, in it alike.
Absolutely, Dan. Let's move on to the roundtable. We've got a couple really newsy, player-specific things to talk about, Dan. We're going to start with you. One of the drums I've been beating, certainly since we've been on this podcast together, but really, with the exception of one transfer window that brought in Dax McCarty, Juninho, Bastian Schweinsteiger, and Nemanja Nikolić, the Chicago Fire basically haven't done anything under Nelson Rodriguez, and there was always promises of, oh, we're going to do things to improve the team, and they had one really good January. They made the playoffs and basically hadn't made any improvements, with the exception of Alexander Katai, really, since then. But now they've added Nico Gaitán in a position that I think absolutely needed filling, and I'm feeling slightly less pessimistic about the Chicago Fire. Who is Nico Gaitán, and what will his role be to put out the dumpster fire in Bridgeview, Illinois?
Yeah, apparently they are in talks with, I'm going to butcher the name, so I'm not going to attempt it, but it is a team, from the Chinese Super League or whatever they call themselves out there. Nico Gaitán, a Uruguayan or Argentinian playmaker, either one off the top of my head, formerly of Benfica and Atletico Madrid. His move from Benfica to Atletico Madrid didn't pan out, ended up cashing out and going to China. A really good player in the midfield. He can play out wide a little bit, but Gaitán is a playmaker and a number 10 to play through, which kind of gives them a lot of danger with guys like Katai and Nemanja Nikolić up there. It helps take the attention off of them, and put CJ Sapong, as we saw over the weekend when he played, against LA Galaxy. So, you know, they've got some good attacking pieces there. Problem is they don't really have anybody that can, like, really draw attention away from somebody in the way that David Akam was able to, in his, like, one good, like, 4-month stint, in MLS, or one, I'd say scintillating stint in MLS. You know, he's a decent player, but, was absolutely scintillating over that time, drew a lot of attention away from guys like Nikolić, Juninho, and a few others on that squad that made that team, into a playoff team there for the Chicago Fire. That one, you know, that you were referring to. So bring in Nico Gaitán. They've been looking for some type of a number 10, a true number 10 to get into this team for a while. I've had some failed moves with a few other guys, that they were in negotiations with to bring. So, Nico Gaitán, I believe, is getting close to the finish line, not quite over it yet, because, there's still some back and forth between the Chinese team and Chicago Fire, but all signs point to Nico Gaitán coming to Chicago, within the next month at least. I think it'll be a good move for them. Whether or not it puts them into a different category is remained to be seen. But good things for Chicago Fire for going to get Nico Gaitán. And hopefully that deal gets across the finish line.
Moving on, Dan, we have not potted since the LA Galaxy resolved all of their roster situations leading up to the roster compliance deadline. That included, unrelated, the selling of forward Kai Kamara to China. That's been discussed out in the public space and amongst Galaxy, the Galaxy cooler talk watering holes, so I won't go too much into detail. Ultimately, all the way down to the final minutes, the LA Galaxy ultimately decided to buy out Giovanni Dos Santos. And apparently there is some interest in him, Dan, but there's a lot of precedent that suggests that, you know, MLS teams could be getting him for, say, a league minimum contract. There's a situation with that with Jack McInerney, who was waived by the Portland Timbers, I want to say maybe 2-3 years ago, and the Galaxy brought him back on a veteran minimum contract. So Giovanni Dos Santos for $6.5 million, no way. I think Giovanni Dos Santos for $2 million, even if you think you're going to get good Gio, is still a huge risk. But Giovanni Dos Santos for, you know, $65,000 and what is it, 59 cents or however that ends up rounding up, seems plausible. And then so the Galaxy have also added Joe Corona, U.S. international, who spent most of his career in Liga MX, kind of a fringe U.S. national teamer in a number eight kind of role for most of his career at the international senior level. All of these moves are kind of a little bit interesting to me, Dan. You know, Galaxy fans joked that Kai Kamara was trying to pull a Jaime Pinedo at the last minute. I'm not really sure where this came from. As far as Kamara was concerned, you know, reportedly he wanted between $2 and $3 million salary. I assume Ola Kamara is aware of the roster rules and knew that the Galaxy didn't really have any room for that, and that they didn't have a lot of flexibility in order to give him a TAM deal, and the money that he was asking would have necessitated him being a DP, and the Galaxy certainly didn't need a fifth designated player going into, you know, the final 4 days before roster compliance. So I'm not really sure about the timing of that, how that wasn't discussed sooner, and, you know, maybe a move would have been made in January that would have been easier for moving him within the league to get value in the form of league-based assets, or moving him internationally when most of the European continent still had the transfer window open. So, you know, I respect his decision in terms of wanting to get the money that he believes he deserves, and that somebody, ultimately a Chinese club with a whole bunch of money, was able to pay in order to set his family up successfully. I also get the sense that maybe, you know, Kamara came into the team last year, and, you know, they had the whole preseason. Zlatan wasn't signed until 2 to 3 weeks into the regular season. I think Kamara spent, you know, that entire offseason after the trade from Columbus thinking that he was going to be the man up top, and then immediately the Galaxy had an opportunity to get Zlatan, and then Kamara kind of got shifted into a related but not really his best role, and he kind of felt that he was playing second fiddle. So I wonder how much that played into it. You know, I think ultimately it was the right decision for the LA Galaxy. I think Giovanni Dos Santos was a sunk cost. You know, I don't see the benefit of saying we had to keep Zlatan. We know we have to pay Giovanni Dos Santos his money. Let's just truncate out and prorate the money that he was owed for 2019 to X number of years. It was going to be between 3 and 5, I think, to make it plausible for us to buy him down with TAM, effectively just have him hang around in order to sign Zlatan to a long-term extension. That just never really made sense to me. You are going to have to give Gio the $6.5 million anyways. I got the sense going into this year that no matter what was going on with the coaching staff, barring GBS being able to completely resurrect his career, in which case he wasn't able to do that in the Barcelona Academy, he wasn't able to do that with the Liga MX, with the Mexican national team. Like, if that couldn't work, you know, how many more things had to go right for Gio in order for him to actually play at the level of the player who, you know, scored that fantastic goal against Tim Howard in the Gold Cup final in 2013, I believe. So, you know, I thought that he was a lame duck. I thought it was a sunk cost. I think everybody in Galaxy Land was ultimately ready to just rid their hands of it. And ultimately, I think this is an indication of a failure from the front office as far as the acquisition and the management of Gio, and then ultimately in anybody trying to get something out of him. You know, he worked under he was in position to be under 4 different head coaches. Bruce Arena and his staff were on the record saying that they didn't want him. They didn't want to deal with that circus and who he was. From an off-the-field standpoint, obviously Kurt Anolfo was never going to get any respect from Giovanni Dos Santos and wasn't given the time fairly or unfairly by the front office. Siggy Smith couldn't make it work despite you know, all the good work that he was able to do, rest in peace, you know, as a coach in MLS. And then I think this was clearly an indication that Dennis DeClosen and GBS just wanted that thing out of their hair. And, you know, when the Galaxy signs Laton, the immediate media availability, Chris Klein and Pete Vianis, then general manager of the Galaxy, was asked about, you know, you've signed Laton. Clearly you're underpaying him, but clearly he wants to be here. If he wants something, you know, you're locked in as far as DPs. You already have Jonathan Dos Santos on a long-term deal. You have Giovanni Dos Santos on a lot of money. You have Roman Alessandrini on a lot of money. Like, you're locked into DPs. What if something comes up with Zlatan or another opportunity? And the answer collectively from the Galaxy brass was, we're the LA Galaxy. We have the flexibility to move any one of these guys. We have the ability to restructure contracts or give them TAM, or there's enough market for them internationally to where we can move them on. Obviously, Roman Alessandrini being a French citizen, there's a whole bunch of opportunities in Europe should the Galaxy want him to move, or the other way around. Obviously, Jonathan Dos Santos would have a market in Mexico, but, you know, everything they were saying is that they could move somebody, and ultimately they weren't able to move somebody, or they said that keeping Gio and being forced to move one of their actual contributing starters wasn't worth it. So I think this is ultimately, it was the right decision. You know, ding dong, the witch is dead, but man, what a waste of 4 or 5 years and an excess, if you believe the rumors regarding the transfer fee, in excess of $30 million on a player who was an absolute dud in MLS, couldn't work under multiple coaching staffs, and really was brought in to try and tap into the Mexican soccer fan in Los Angeles, and I would argue failed spectacularly. And, you know, meanwhile, everybody's buying a Carlos Vela jersey. So that doesn't really make sense to me. I like Joe Corona. Now, knowing those two moves, the Galaxy don't really need a pure number 10 centrally. They don't need to play with two strikers anymore, because it's basically Zlatan and then Chris Pontius. So I think there's a very good possibility that GBS moves on to a 4-2-3-1, which would necessitate having a midfield partner that actually works with Jonathan Dos Santos, i.e. not an over-the-hill Janino, who am I thinking of right now? Perry Kitchen. Joe Corona, familiar with the style of play that Jonathan Dos Santos is going to be interested in. He can be the number 8. Jonah can be the roaming number 6. And then I think your front 3, you know, maybe a little bit of total football between the 3 in terms of positioning, will probably be Antuna, the Argentine, who GBS was really high on. Sebastian Legette, who I think is in position to have a healthy, spectacular 2019. And Roman Alessandrini, I would argue the second best player on the LA Galaxy. I've done enough rambling, Dan. Why don't we talk about Kenny Saif and FC Cincinnati?
Yeah, FC Cincinnati have their third attacking player on their roster. His name is Kenny Saif. It is alone jokes about the third attacking player, but really, he's like the third legitimate attacking player they have on their roster. Whatever. And it's the only one that they can actually play next to Fernando Adi, because Darren Maddox and Fernando Adi can't play together. Because then they would have no other striker. So, welcome to FC Cincinnati, Kenny Saif. You're thrown into a heck of a situation right now. I think it's a good move. He was a solid player for Anderlecht. A lot of injury issues recently. I'm sure Anderlecht are at a point where they are, you know, through this point, they've been so used to whoever's been playing his spot, left mid, left wing, that you know, Saif, it's going to be hard for Saif to break back in with consistent time as the season gets close to coming to a close for them, and cup ties, and the way the Belgian league does its, you know, kind of placement and playoff things. So, you know, it's going to be hard for him to get time there and get time to correctly rehab. He's going to walk right into the starting lineup. Him and Roland Lamont isn't terrible as attacking wide players. It still needs some sort of a number 10. It'll be interesting to see how he fits this situation. I don't think he's going to be a help immediately, just because he hasn't been quite fresh yet. But it will be nice to kind of see him move to FC Cincinnati. And it's a good move for FC Cincinnati, in going and getting an American player that they can bring in, someone who is a little bit bigger name than necessarily Fernando Adi, and Darren Maddox up top. So props to them for getting their third, fourth attacker, whatever they have on their roster at this point. And someone who can actually play on the field with Fernando Adi at the same time. Good stuff for them. Whether it makes a difference or not, and how things shake out for them, this, we'll see.
Excellent stuff, Dan. And the last topic that we have, Blake Smith, who is a starter on the defensive line for FC Cincinnati in 2018 in USL, has officially been waived by the club. And then also a Will Parchman tweet that went semi-viral this year, three first-round draft picks in the MLS Super Draft were ultimately cut from their team prior to before preseason ended and weren't signing anything, and I presume are now looking for opportunities in the various USL leagues that maybe haven't kicked off or still in preseason or still looking to fill out the roster, or maybe they're looking at other opportunities. I'm not sure. In any case, Dan, I feel like both of these are a trend. We have pretty good data at this point in MLS 3.0 for existing USL teams becoming MLS expansion teams and that not transitioning well in terms of most of their USL roster. How many guys who were on that last USL championship from Orlando were with Orlando by the end of their first year, and then how many of them were actually contributors at the MLS level? You could really argue the only one from that team was Dom Dwyer, who then went to Sporting Kansas City, balled out, and then got a record transfer fee as a forward to Orlando in their second year of existence. You know, we can make similar arguments in MLS 2.0 with, you know, the Montreal Impacts of the world or the Seattle Sounders and the Portland Timbers. And then you look at Minnesota United as well, who had a lot of holdover guys. Granted, Miguel Ibarra and Christian Ramirez, who you knew had some upside, but there's just a lot of those guys at the second division hadn't really made anything of that. And we don't have a lot of good data that suggests that very good or above average players in USL can go to an MLS team and then transition that very easily. For the most part, if anybody sticks around, it's a really workmanlike defender, or a goalkeeper who becomes a backup, or a number six or a number eight who's just one of the guys, or who's your fourth best midfield in a midfield of four, for example. But, you know, Enzo Martinez, who was an MVP finalist for the USL the past 2 years, this would have been in 2016 and 2017, was the best 11 both those years, comes to the Colorado Rapids, and only lasts one year, isn't really played in a position to be successful, doesn't really play well when he's actually in the role that suited him, and then ultimately has to go back to Charlotte Independence. Nothing against Enzo Martinez. He's a wonderful person. He's a good player. But I just think that there's a lot of data that suggests that MLS has moved on to the point where it's separated to where, you know, 5-6 years ago, you were building a team where legitimately half the roster would have been made up guys who went through the college soccer system and could still be contributors. And now the best of that talent is fighting just to get an MLS roster spot. And then even then, you know, it's only a handful of guys who are actually going to play significant minutes, one of whom I think could be Andre Shinyashiki in their first year in MLS, and who knows whether or not they stick around. Some of that is the academy system. Some of that is the influx of young international talent who is taking the role of that. But really, Dan, I guess the question that I'm generally asking, or I'm wondering now, is I'm thinking about, you know, from the standpoint of USL being a developmental league, or I think about the Jamie Vardy tracked, you know, but in MLS, for example, where you have a guy who slips through the cracks, who isn't a part of a significant development academy, goes to a college team that isn't one of the bigger ones, and then ends up in USL and then works their way up. There's not really there isn't a good precedent for that in the same way that, you know, there were guys who just were raw talent or weren't very well put together in their senior year of, you know, travel and then high school baseball, who needed to start out in single A and then were able to work their way up, rather than, you know, somebody who was a top prospect out of college, for example, who spent a year or two in double A and triple A and then was ultimately able to come in. You know, I don't remember offhand, you know, how many minor league games that Tim Lincecum, for example, had to play before he was ready to start and be the ace for the San Francisco Giants. And, you know, there's a number of examples of that in hockey. But from the standpoint of USL being a developmental league or college being a developmental system, and both of those providing a feasible, reliable tract in MLS 3.0 to playing in MLS, I'm not sure that either of those things are existing anymore based on how we've seen expansion teams from USL come into MLS and those guys just not really stick around or not be any more than, you know, the league minimum $100,000 guy who's going to play here and there when needed but isn't really a part of the starting 11. You know, he's just a roster player. And I don't know how much college is going to play into that. And I think the, you know, waiving of Blake Smith, the fact that so many super round, first round draft picks haven't made the team, the fact that, you know, half the league is declining on the draft picks they have in the third and the fourth round because there isn't a player on the board who they think is even going to make the team. I just think maybe now, you know, that those two are just becoming less viable to where, you know, the kid in Wyoming who isn't in a situation to get with a good club team, you know, who has to go to a middle tier college soccer program is just not maligned, but, you know, it's just he's going to go to USL and that's going to be it. There isn't a whole lot of examples anymore of guys really falling through the cracks of somebody who didn't get picked up by a club earlier and had to play all 4 years in college, but then turned out to be something good, or a guy who just wasn't picked up by an MLS team and then ultimately he played in USL and he worked his way up. There isn't a good example for that anymore, and I don't know that we're going to see that other than a couple sparing situations with maybe a little bit of luck and being in the right situation in the right time for an individual player. I don't know that there's a path for guys in USL who are not already tied to an MLS team through a homegrown contract or a super draft contract, that there's a path for them to getting into MLS. And I don't know that, I think it's increasingly, there's a shrinking market for opportunities for college players who aren't already tied to an MLS team or who aren't at one of the major programs. With that, Dan, let's move on to pick-ems. We will start with the first nationally televised game of the Saturday matches. FC Dallas hosting the LA Galaxy with some major question marks about the availability of Roman Alessandrini and Zlatan Ibrahimovic. This will be at 3:30 p.m. on Univision. Dan, who you got and why is it going to be Dallas when Zlatan doesn't play?
Actually, I might... It's hard because the Galaxy don't really have another striker outside of Zlatan. Who would you play there?
I think it's, if you had to, Pontius is the closest thing that you have to a number nine. You know, with the way that he played, like, I wouldn't like it, but I think it'd be a major statement by GBS if they were to put Efrain Alvarez in there, or maybe they're trying to move that's really the only other options you have. You wouldn't put Emma Boateng up there as a lone striker if you were stuck, if you were married to the 4-4-2. This weekend, I think it would have to be Pontius as the number nine and then Emma Boateng underneath. If you're going 4-2-3-1 with Joe Corona, I assume his paperwork will be in by that point. He'll be eligible for selection. I would go 4-2-3-1. We won't even get talking about the back line. It's going to be David Lingman goal. I would have Joe Corona and Jonah Dos Santos. I would have the Jays in the two spot in the midfield. Assuming Alessandrini is able to go, it would be Alessandrini, Leggett, and Antuna. If Alessandrini isn't able to go, I would probably go the other Argentine whose name I can't remember, or I would have him with Boateng, and I would just have Pontius up top. And you're probably looking at sitting deep and countering and hoping for a 0-0 draw.
Yeah, so I figured it would be Pontius. I just didn't know if they still had Jack McInerney, who, you know, MLS journeyman. Anyways, because I don't pay attention to the LA Galaxy's roster beyond Zlatan and no more Ola Kamara. So, this one, FC Dallas are incredibly boring. I think without Zlatan and Alessandrini, the Galaxy will be incredibly boring. This screams 0-0.
Okay, I'm going to go with 1-0 to FC Dallas on this one, and I think it's going to be, this would make sense to any Rapids listeners, but it's going to be a prototypical, like, nothing opportunity and Dom Baggi making something out of nothing, and that's going to be it. Like, there's going to be one moment of excitement, and I think the rest of this is going to be a boring 1-0 victory for FC Dallas. Let's move on to the nightcap, Dan. Speaking of the Colorado Rapids, Seattle Sounders hosting the Pids. This will be at 10 p.m. Eastern on ESPN+. Dan, who you got and why?
I'm actually going to go with Seattle in this one. I think Colorado will give a good account of themselves. I think it will be interesting. I think they will put up a much better fight than what FC Cincinnati did in Seattle. But this Seattle team looks very good. I'm afraid if Colorado gets caught trying to put too many numbers forward, a ridiculous counterattack between Ruidíaz, Rodríguez, Lodeiro, and Jordan Morris will just absolutely consume the back line. But I think, if anything, is probably the biggest weakness for Colorado. I'll say, if this game was played in Colorado, I think it might go differently, and I think Colorado could probably scout a win. But I'll say 3-1 to the Sounders, but it's not going to be a dominant 3-1. It's going to be it's 2-1, and the Rapids are pushing for a goal in the last 10 minutes, and Seattle, you know, gets one on the break to finish off the match. One of those where the scoreline isn't indicative of how close the match is. But yeah, 3-1 to Seattle for me on this.
I was going to pick the exact same thing, so of course it's not going to happen, Dan. You know, I think Kai Kamara against Chad Marshall, particularly on set pieces or any time you've got any one of the fullbacks getting forward to lump across into the box, I think is going to be a fantastic matchup. I think Kai Kamara will win one of those to get a header goal for the Colorado Rapids, but I question where the Rapids are defensively right now. Dylan Cerna is doing some good things offensively as the starting left back in preseason, but still has some defensive liabilities. And I just, with Court Ford and Danny Wilson are still out with injuries right now. I heard from a source this week that the Rapids are optimistic about Tommy Smith being available, but if that doesn't happen, and I assume since we're recording this on Thursday night, that the Rapids are not challenging the red card against Big Axel, nor is it going to be overturned by the disciplinary committee, you're looking at a midfield combination of one of the three of Danny Wilson, Declan Wynn, and Tommy Smith. That doesn't give me a whole lot of optimism, seeing that Rodriguez played really, really well against FC Cincinnati. Jordan Morris clearly is completely recovered. And even if you didn't have those two, like Nicolò Daire or Raul Ruy Diaz is looking almost as dangerous as Deuce and Oba did back in the day. That, you know, maybe I'm being hyperbolic in that, but so I think Seattle will be able to get two goals relatively easily. I think the Rapids will have to throw caution to the wind, probably with two late offensive substitutions, and they'll just get count on the break, and it's just going to be a case of Declan Wynn 1v1 defending with Nicolò Daire. You're going to have a bad time. So 3-1 to the Seattle Sounders. Let's move on to the Sunday matches, Dan. We'll start with the ESPN match, the early game, 3 p.m. Eastern, New York City FC with their home opener against DC United. Dan, who you got, and is this game going to extra innings?
Not sure. I'm going to go DC United on this one. New York City FC looked incredibly, like, disorganized in the second half, and they got beat by a Orlando City team that was featuring Tesho Akindele as their main striker for a while. That, you know, didn't get beat, but they looked bad in that second half. Probably should have gotten beaten, honestly, if VAR had correctly called the penalty kick. I would put my money on Dwyer or Nani to finish that penalty kick. But crazier things have happened. However, New York City FC looked bright at times, but I think they're still missing. Mitrida's very good. They have good wingers. They're missing a number 9. They obviously know it. They've been attempting to get it. And until they get that, I think they're going to look relatively incomplete. So you're going to look for guys like Brad Ring to be the guy who's going and scoring goals for them. And Brad Ring is not the guy who should be scoring goals for them. There's a lot on that team. Mitrida, Maxi Morales, but they're no finish off. Mitrida and Morales are very much creators and playmakers. I think they get that. They're going to struggle a bit. They've got a lot of guys that have returned and the guys that they are familiar with, and they looked good against Atlanta. I know how, you know, the home road thing goes in MLS. I'll take DC United in this one by score of 2-0, just because I think at the moment DC United are a much better team than New York City FC.
Lucho Acosta and Wayne Rooney were fantastic against Atlanta over the weekend. A very, very short travel. You know, they might even be, I don't know if they're taking a bus or a train or actually like a 30-minute flight up there from D.C., but in any case, not anything too long for Wayne Rooney to deal with. And that field still, just with the smallness, doesn't require a whole lot of running. So even at his age, Wayne Rooney isn't going to have to tire himself out, and there's still going to be space to work in. And it's prone to counterattacks when there are transitions in the midfield as far as possession. I think Russell Knauss and Junior Moreno are going to eat that up all day, every day. I'll say Maxi Morales gets something probably on a free kick, in this one against Bill Hamid, but it's going to be 2-1 to DC United. And I'll say that both goals will be a Lucho Acosta assist, maybe not a primary assist, maybe a hockey assist, and it'll be Wayne Rooney with a brace to get the DC United a 2-1 win over the Citizens. Let's move on to the nationally televised Sunday games, Dan. Atlanta United hosting FC Cincinnati, 5 p.m. Eastern. This will be on ESPN. Weary Atlanta United, an FC Cincinnati team, Dan, that we see that they are not very good when they have to play on the road in an NFL stadium on turf.
Yeah, I think Atlanta's got some frustrations to get out. They were kind of tight. They never really got a good chance. And then Monterey, 10 minutes after they had worn them down, I think they're going to kind of come out with their hair on fire. Two bad performances to start off. Apparently, I say this in the least serious way possible. There's already pressure on, as it seems, one radical man or Atlanta United fan is organizing a DeBoer out protest, outside, BBVA comp, or not BBVA, whatever, BMW, Mercedes Benz, whatever fancy car.
MBA.
Mercedes Benz Arena. Yes. There we go. I forget. I don't know. Sponsors change so many times. I'm done trying to remember who it is. Fancy car, big arena, NFL stadium, that place. Apparently some fan is already organizing that fun stuff. So, I'm not serious about it. I don't know how serious this fan about it is, how serious this fan is about it, but it's freaking hilarious. But I think still Atlanta United second is probably better than what FC Cincinnati is going to throw out. So I'm going to put Atlanta on this one. I will say 3-0, and it will be quite.
I've got a really funny story to share with you, Dan. This was when the lineups were coming out for MLS Cup 2019. In the comment section from Atlanta United's official Twitter account, there was a fan. I will say that based on the Twitter profile, looked like clearly a Georgia native or a Georgia resident, someone who was generally a sports fan, but probably one of those people who, you know, is like the general fact about them and then like, I love sports, and then uses all the hashtags of the city they're from in the order in which they care about them. So I think, you know, this person was probably a diehard Falcons fan, maybe Georgia football, probably Atlanta Braves, but only passively caring about Atlanta United. And so this Twitter account that did not use any, that in my initial peering of them in profile picture, cover photo, Twitter bio, and first couple of tweets did not immediately give away a diehard Atlanta United fan, said, if they lose the game, fire Tata. So you had MLS Cup 2018. Tata Martino already said that he wasn't coming back. All the rumors were that he was going to Liga MX, or that he was going to the Mexican national team. And there was a fan, presumably who cared about Atlanta United, who said, if they lose the game, fire Tata Martino. So maybe this is the same person. Maybe they got season tickets over the off season. I'm not sure. In any case.
Yeah, I don't know. There's a whole account and it's hilarious.
Oh my God. That is, I need to check that out to sort of like hate troll it, if that makes sense. In any case, Dan.
Oh yeah.
I think Atlanta is absolutely brooding in this one. I think they're ripe for all of that angst and frustration that they have. And, you know, lonely FC Cincinnati just happens to be the next body that's immediately in their way. I think PT Martinez and Justin Martinez come out and absolutely dunk on FC Cincinnati. This will be their first home game at Mercedes-Benz this calendar year, right?
Yep. Ceremony, banners, all the shenanigans.
Yeah, so I'll say 3-0 to Atlanta. I'll say Justin Martinez gets a goal and they'll be jogging by the 70th minute. And, you know, just Atlanta's going to take out all their frustrations on FC Cincinnati. And rightfully so, I think we should feel a little bit bad for them. Last game on the weekend, Dan, we have LAFC hosting Portland Timbers, another West Coast cracker of a match as far as I'm concerned. 7:30 p.m. Eastern on FS1. Dan, who you got and why?
Yeah, I'm going to go with LAFC in this. And I get all the snow, whatnot. Portland was up a man, on the road, with a lead and coughed it up multiple times. I think they are an interesting team. They've got a long, literal road ahead of them as they will be on the road for a significant portion of the season. LAFC is tough. I don't entire. I still have questions about this Portland team. You know, the aging significant pieces of this team will hold up over the season. Going down to LAFC against a team that is very physical, very fast, and very freaking good. I think it's going to pose a lot of problems. That atmosphere is wild and is going to cause a lot of problems for Portland as well. If there's any team that can, that has shown that they've been able to do it in difficult circumstances, Portland has been doing over the last year or so. But at best, I think Portland gets a draw if they play. Like, that's the best case scenario for them, in my opinion. I'll say LAFC 2-0 in this one. I'm not confident in Portland in this situation itself. But LAFC, home team, they'll be riding that high. They finally started getting things going in that second half against Sporting Kansas City. Still kind of coming out of preseason, so I expect to see more of that. Like I said, still got a lot of questions about Portland, so we'll see how it goes.
I'll take LAFC in this one as well, Dan. I think this will mirror maybe the narrative that we saw last weekend against Sporting Kansas City. I think Portland will have a couple good moments. I think it'll be their main stars that ultimately create the goal that they get. But I think LAFC is going to be able to respond, and I think they'll be the better team over the course of the 90 minutes. And I think the final scoreline will show it. You know, LAFC is a fantastic team. They're fantastic at home, and I think this Timbers defense is definitely one that can be had. I think they'll look to play defensive and try and counter. I think Diego Valeri and Chara are going to be fantastic, and them and Blanco are going to be able to find a goal. But I think LAFC is going to be the superior team, and it's going to show that in the scoreline by a final score of 2-1. That is it for us, folks. Dan, it is time for last words. Do you have any last words, and where can people find you on Twitter?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at SpurrierDaniel94. I don't have any last words. I've said a lot tonight already, but hang out with us this weekend. We got a lot of great soccer ahead. I will be at Sporting Kansas City versus the Philadelphia Union. If you're out there, if you listen, you are going to be at the game. Hit me up. I'll come say hi. It's going to be a lot of fun this weekend. A lot of decent matchups. A lot of matchups that I'm kind of glad I'm working during some of them, but we'll see how it goes. But MLS is back, so I'll probably still watch it anyways.
Good stuff, Dan. Listeners, you can follow me on Twitter at LWSMattPollard. Check out my Dan and all of our Last Word content at lastwordonsoccer.com and at Last Word SC across all social media platforms. You can subscribe to Last Word Soccer Club Radio. Just search Last Word Radio anywhere you get your podcasts. You'll find us and a whole bunch of other great stuff from the Last Word Network. Thank you to our sponsors, Roughneck Scarves, the official scarf supplier of MLS, USL, and US Soccer. Get your custom scarves for your group or team at roughneckscarves.com. That does it for us, folks. We'll see you next week.